Welcome to Mandates and Megaphones, hosted by Jeremy Maggs. Unpacking the politics, promises, and power plays behind the G20 summit.
Hello and welcome to Mandates and Megaphones here on MoneyWeb, brought to you by Standard Bank. I'm Jeremy Maggs. Now, across the globe, the gender credit gap has widened to an estimated $17 trillion US dollars. It's a silent but powerful drag on economic growth. And it's not just about fairness. It's about scale. It's about innovation. It's about untapped opportunity. In Africa, where women are already the backbone of informal economies, the lack of access to finance isn't just a barrier. It really is a choke point on growth, inclusion, and stability. And as the G20 summit approaches, the business community is now being asked to do more than just make commitments. It's being asked to act. And my guest today is Naledzani Mosumani, who's head of enterprise and supply development at the Standard Bank Group, a powerful voice in the B20 Inclusion Task Force. And she argues that gender finance is not just a social issue, it's an economic imperative. So, Naledzani, a very warm welcome to you. And maybe let's set the scene, first of all. Why is closing the gender credit gap not just a moral issue, but now an urgent economic one?
Thanks, Jeremy. So closing the gender gap is important because women contribute to economic development. They create jobs. They improve the quality of the lives of the people that they employ, of the people within the communities that they operate within. And therefore, making sure that they have the appropriate funding mechanisms and appropriate business development mechanisms or support structures is important if we want to move our country and our continent forward, and if we want to transform and be more inclusive.
$17 trillion US dollars is a staggering number, difficult to get one's head around. Maybe just explain to me what that figure actually means on the ground and particularly on this continent.
So when you look at sub-Saharan Africa, the funding gap for women in business is sitting at about $42 billion US dollars, which you have said is astronomical. And what that practically means is you are finding women who are in business but do not have access to funding to manage their businesses as optimally as possible, do not have access to grow their businesses. And when we start thinking about the overall impact that women have in inclusive growth, in economic development, it means we're not creating sufficient opportunities for those women-owned SMEs to be successful.
Let me pick you up on that phrase, sufficient opportunities, then. How is the gap holding back the continent's broader developmental potential, do you think?
So I think it has a massive gap. When women typically start businesses, they start businesses considering everyone around them. So it's never a business that's just run for themselves. They consider their employees, they consider their family members. We also know that across the continent, most houses are headed by women. And therefore, when you start thinking about not having sufficient support across the continent for these businesses, it ultimately means that kids might not be able to go to school, which contributes to unemployment. It means that we're not generating sufficient skills for the different economic sectors that operate within the continent. And it ultimately means that we're not growing as a continent.
So there's a real domino effect there. So we set the scene, and again, I keep coming back to that $17 trillion US dollars. So let's talk about closing that gap. But you're not going to close that gap, Naledzani, unless we overcome structural barriers. So in your opinion, then, what are the biggest structural barriers that women are facing in accessing credit and capital? It's not easy, as you've intimated.
Yeah, it really isn't easy. And, you know, the structural barriers really differ depending on the countries that these women are located. You find that in some countries there is a lack of land ownership rights, right, which impacts these women's ability to actually have access to adequate collateral to run their businesses optimally. In some countries, you also find that there's incomplete National Credit Bureau data, which means that there's actually no credit information on these women-owned businesses. And sometimes where there is data, the data is fragmented because it's sitting across multiple sources. We also find that financial literacy for women in business is a challenge as well. Typically, most of the businesses that we are seeing that are operated by women, particularly in those, you know, informal economies, are necessity-based businesses. So we are seeing that because these businesses are necessity-based businesses, they don't really have the appropriate business development skills. They don't have the appropriate financial management skills. They don't have the appropriate technical skills to run their businesses effectively and to actually start scaling and growing their businesses in a way that they can be sustainable and thrive.
You talked about data either not being available or the data is not complete. What type of data are we talking about here?
So we're talking about credit data. So typically when you approach a bank, the bank will check your information against what's reflected in the credit bureau. And that really shows your history in terms of, you know, who you've lent money from, how much you currently owe on current facilities. So the inability to have that data means that, number one, typically financial institutions can't give you an adequate credit score because we don't understand how good you are at paying your debt. And it also means that if we don't understand how good you are paying your debt, we can't support your business as optimally as possible. We also see that in some cases, these women don't operate from business banking accounts or even personal banking accounts. They operate in cash, meaning we also don't have a view of how their business is tracking. There's no record of how much information, how much flows within your business in terms of revenue, how much you pay from an expense perspective. All of those data points have an impact in assessing an individual as well as a business's opportunity to get access to credit.
The barriers themselves that you've been talking about, is there a huge difference, a stark difference between the formal and the informal sectors?
Yes, there definitely is. When you start looking at the informal sector, we find that these SMEs do not know where to go to get access to information. We also see that these SMEs are not registered because they don't understand the importance or the benefit of registering their businesses, whether it is for tax purposes or your CIPC registration. When you move up towards your formalized businesses, typically these businesses, you know, have a good business idea, are operating, but typically also need support to scale their businesses. And we are seeing that some of the women-owned enterprises really struggle when they need, you know, that accelerated funding to grow their businesses.
Which then puts a lot of onus of responsibility on the banks themselves. And I wonder whether traditional banking models then are still fundamentally biased, even if it's unintentional. And that is maybe also a big structural barrier to gaining the credit and the finance.
Yeah, I would maybe say more biased in that we can only really look at you based on the information that we have, right? That is how we currently look at our clients from a credit perspective. And within financial institutions, there is a lot of work that is happening to see what does alternative data look like? What are alternative funding models? I know within the bank, they do look at that across the continent. However, in solving for, you know, the funding gap that we see women in business having, we also do partner. So we partner with DFIs, to help de-risk some of our lending solutions, which is critical because that creates an opportunity for us to give SMEs access to funding, and typically SMEs that we might have not been able to fund because they might have seemed a bit more riskier. So when you start looking at how do you cater for some of the traditional funding models, looking at blended finance and guarantee schemes to de-risk SME lending is critical because those DFIs do come in with a view of we want to give access to more SMEs and let's work with you to give access. And that really looks at guarantee schemes or blended finance in terms of part grant, part funding models. Public and private partnerships are important if we want to broaden financing options for SMEs. So partnerships with your local governments and partnerships with some of your, you know, SOEs really do play an important role in helping to create that access to funding.
So let me push you a little bit then on that notion of partnerships. And I want to talk now about private sector and policy alignment. So all well and good in overcoming the structural barriers that we've just been speaking about. But how then can banks, investors, and policymakers align better, in other words, partner more effectively to unlock the capital that you've been talking about?
So I think it's important to have, you know, those regular dialogues. Public sector creates an opportunity for the right private sector institutions to come together and have the important conversations in terms of what is financial inclusion and how do we drive financial inclusion and what do we need to consider in driving financial inclusion. Even if you look at some of the recommendations that came through from the B20 task force, we see that these recommendations were recommendations that have come together through a number of players within the market. So as much as our CEO is the co-chair of the Financial Infrastructure Task Force, he had another co-chair as well. So working together across industry to solve for this economy, not just women in business, but typically SMEs that we don't support, sharing ideas and also identifying, you know, accredited institutions, accredited organizations that work with these SMEs, bringing in international organizations such as your bigger international DFIs is critical in shaping good financial inclusion agenda that speaks to the needs of the SMEs that we aim to serve.
Nalatzani, I always get very nervous when I hear the word conversations. While I understand that dialogue is critical, often we can find a lot of wheels spinning when that is happening. I wonder what some of the more practical levers are that the private sector can pull right now in order to get some real traction.
So KPIs, you know, are important and putting down those practical levers is critical. And some of the things to consider is, you know, setting aside a portion of your loan book to fund, whether it's women in business, previously disadvantaged SMEs. That is a practical figure that you can put down as a target. Creating targets that look at SME growth, SME turnover growth, looking at what interventions have we put in place as financial institutions to drive the growth of the SMEs that we work with, creating KPIs that look at job creation. How many jobs have we been able to create? How many jobs have we been able to sustain through these initiatives that we put in place to support these SMEs?
Providing, of course, proper risk assessment and due diligence is done.
Yes, definitely. Risk assessment is important. Due diligence is important. And even when you start thinking about, you know, the due diligence, the risk assessments, walking the journey with SMEs is also important. When we run our enterprise and supply development programs, the funding typically comes after the business development support, right? So there's an element of hand-holding, coaching, mentoring, doing a full-on diagnostic of the business to understand what gaps are sitting within that business, and then putting in interventions to capacitate that business. And then once that process is completed, being very clear in terms of what type of funding you need and how that funding will be utilized. Because when you approach Standard Bank or any other financial institution, they need to understand where that money will go and what it will be utilized for.
I'm in conversation with Naledzani Mosomani, who's head of enterprise and supplier development at the Standard Bank Group, also a powerful voice in the B20 Inclusion Task Force, as we look at the issue of gender finance. And it's not just, as she suggested, a social issue, but also an economic imperative. So, Naledzani, we've set the scene. We've looked at some of the structural barriers. We've looked at private sector and policy alignment. Let's look at those B20 levers now. And are you worried that there is a risk, perhaps, of a very bold agenda being sidelined as a nice to have rather than a growth driver?
No, I'm not worried. I don't think the woman inclusion agenda or the financial inclusion agenda is a nice to have. When we start looking at economic development, which touches on an element of economic growth, an element of improving the quality of lives of the individuals which live within that economy, you have to start bringing in financial inclusion. We know that when SMEs are financially included, they are empowered. And when they are empowered, they are able to make decisions and run businesses optimally. The ripple effect of that is job creation, which is critical when we start thinking about the fact that we can't keep on paying social grants indefinitely, right? We need to start utilizing the funding that we get, tax payments that SARS gets, to actually grow this economy and to actually create adequate infrastructure for individuals and SMEs to participate actively within this economy. So financial inclusion is important because it ultimately, in the long run, creates individuals and SMEs that are empowered, which in the long run means the society is able to run itself with limited stress on government.
So are there concrete outcomes then that you're hoping to see from this year's event?
Yeah, I think they are. When you look at the recommendations that have been put down by the, you know, the B20 task force in terms of creating funding solutions, de-risking funding solutions, working with SMEs, when you start looking at early stage project preparation facilities to support businesses to be investment ready, when you look at public-private partnerships to broaden financing options and market entry, and when you look at the fact that all of these things are also coupled with making sure that there's clear KPIs and accountability to ensure that the inclusion commitments are monitored and are met, there is it does give me a lot of comfort. And for me, there has been a lot of thought and planning that has gone through into putting down some of these recommendations.
And you're confident that African voices can shape this agenda rather than just react to it?
Definitely confident. Africa has the youngest population globally, and we have a lot of agriculture, we have a lot of mineral resources. We are a vibrant continent, and we need, you know, those clear outcomes and clear measures to create a continent that is thriving, a continent that can sustain itself, a continent that is, you know, manufacturing its own goods as opposed to just being an importer of finished goods. So I am confident that by the G20 being here in Africa gives other countries an opportunity to see how diverse this continent is, how great this continent is, and the power that sits within the African continent.
The sentiment is one thing, positive sentiment, but none of this is going to work, of course, unless there's meaningful commitment from multilateral lenders to bridge this gap. Is there any indication that's going to happen, do you think?
Yes, you are correct. And definitely there is meaningful commitment. We as Standard Bank, you know, speak to multiple DFIs, those that are located within the continent and those that are located outside of the continent. We have entered into partnerships with some of them which focus on increasing funding opportunities for SMEs. So the intent is there, and there is action behind the commitments. And I know we're not just the only financial institution that has been very deliberate in making sure that we can lock opportunities. And there's a lot happening within the DFI space as well, in terms of, creating infrastructure across the continent. So the intent is there, and there is clear action, in my view.
And of course, multilateral lenders, I imagine, would be more open and more positive about investment if they see meaningful regional collaboration across the continent. That would surely make financing more accessible and even scalable.
Definitely. And, there's a lot that we need to do, in my view, to capacitate SMEs to start looking at what does intra-Africa trade look like. I think most of the time, when particularly with the SMEs that we work with, when they think trade, they think China, right? But there is markets within the continent, and there is work that needs to be done, and just creating opportunities for SMEs to understand what that looks like. We ran exporter program, which we actually graduated 2 weeks ago, with SMEs that are located in KZN who are exporter ready. And the whole intent of that program was to try and support these SMEs with information in terms of what other regulatory information do you need to make sure that you're able to export across different countries, what type of funding solutions are out there if you want to look at trading across borders. So there is a lot of some additional work that needs to be done to create, space for SMEs to start thinking outside the continent. But then I also think there's also space to do work within South Africa, within the country as well. We do a lot of work with SMEs that are located in townships, and we see that these SMEs are manufacturing, they are creating goods, and they're creating them here in the country. So there's work that needs to be done to say, how do we build, that manufacturing sector locally? How do we localize some of these goods so that the money can flow within the economy and we actually start buying local?
So as we end this conversation, and you've made a very powerful and compelling case, if the gender gap or gender credit gap begins to close meaningfully, and let's say within the next 5 to 10 years, what do you believe the future looks like for African economies?
So I believe the future looks like a continent that is able to sustain itself, a continent that is thriving in terms of market access, thriving in terms of utilizing locally produced goods. If we really are deliberate and intentional in creating opportunities for women-owned SMEs, we do know that the future will have a cohort of SMEs that have scaled, SMEs that are sustainable, SMEs that are successful, and also a cohort of young people that is empowered because of the impact that we know that women-owned SMEs have on overall society.
Naledzani Mosomani, Head of Enterprise and Supply Development at the Standard Bank Group, thank you very much indeed. Now, that $17 trillion US dollar gender credit gap, you will agree with me, isn't just a statistic. It really is a test. It's a test, I think, of whether the world can build growth models that are both inclusive and resilient. So as Africa steps onto the G20 stage, the question isn't whether inclusion matters. It's whether we can afford not to make it central. And that really is food for thought. That's it for this episode of Mandates and Megaphones, brought to you by Standard Bank. I'm Jeremy Maggs. Please join us again next time. And thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to Mandates and Megaphones. You can find more episodes on moneyweb.co.za.